Well, fall has arrived, and that means our insect world out there is preparing for winter. So we thought it a good time to bring back another edition of What's Bugging You, Red River Radio's program about our insect world, with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. This program is made possible tonight by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and tonight we invite you to call in with your questions about our insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Dr. Burden, glad to have you back with us.
I'm glad to be back, Bill.
All right. So this past week on Louisiana Eats, I heard an interesting story. They were talking with a beekeeper, and he was talking about the mite problem that has infected, and what he is doing is interesting, and I wanted to get your comments. So first, we're going to play a little clip from Louisiana Eats this week, and as Poppy Tooker is interviewing a beekeeper out in California, and get your ideas on this.
How much of an effect have you seen from the bee colony collapse issue?
Well, it's a whole new world. I started this nearly 50 years ago, so I've really watched it. Believe me, the last few years have been tough. One of the things that's changed is we had this parasite, a couple different parasites come in this country almost 30 years ago now from Asia. And there are a lot of chemicals out there that most beekeepers use. Most of them are not very good, I mean, as far as toxicity. And I started a program of working with the genetics, working with the survivors of those pathogens and parasites, and did pretty well. We've got to the point where we could coexist with the parasites. And because there's a behavior pattern called a clean gene that very fastidious, they get in there, they groom each other, they clean out the infected cells. But the problem now is the mites themselves, it's a little parasite, carry different viruses. And so you only need a few to start spreading these viruses. Whereas before, I could coexist with a few mites. Now it's getting tough. So these hives here, for the first time this year, I am using a chemical. But it's a natural occurring chemical called thymol that knocks the mites off the bees. And you can only put it on after you pulled the honey. So it's tough. That's all I can say. But, you know, we're farmers, so we just keep going.
That's right. Farmers keep going no matter what. So the invasive species, the mite, did that come from China? Is that where that came from? Or is it really just kind of an Asian problem caused by, you know, global trade issues?
It did originate in Asia. But that's just... There's Part actually five things that are going on here. It's called colony collapse disorder. And you do have the mite, and it acts as a parasite. It invades the breathing tubes that the insect uses to exchange. They don't have lungs, but they have breathing tubes called trachea. And the mites are associated with these viruses. But there's also a fungus. It's a Nosema fungus, and that's actually what the thymol is controlling.
Okay.
Not so much the mites, but it's a more of a fungicide, but it's been used as a general antiseptic throughout history. What's interesting is that this chemical thymol occurs naturally in many plants, and it's named after the thyme plant, T-H-Y-M-E, but okay. T-H-Y-M-O-L.
Right.
And it's been known for years to be an antiseptic. A lot of people use it, put it in mouthwashes and things. But there's also some environmental stressors that we know that's going on as well. Everybody knows about the droughts, and that's affecting the vegetation that the bees are getting their pollen from. Pollen is a major source of protein, especially when they're developing their broods and their eggs. And there's also been some changes in a managerial practices. And so if you look and read up on the research that's been done by research groups, including the USDA, they can't pin it to any one thing. It's a conglomerate. They're working off of each other.
Right.
Everyone is contributing a little bit to the problem. And so they're trying to solve every problem a little bit at a time. But what's interesting about this bill is that most of the colony collapse disorder that we're dealing with right now started back in 2006. This is not a new thing.
Right.
Colony collapse disorder was first noticed in the 1880s, and then in the 1920s, and then in the 1960s. It seems like there's a 40-year cycle.
Yeah, a cyclical issue.
It is a cyclical issue. Of course, we know that the mite was not present back in 1960, but something is occurring, and that's why you can't say, oh, it's just the mite.
Right.
Oh, it's just the fungus. Oh, it's just the virus. There's something that's going on that is cyclical, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next 20 years with this. However, from the journals and the publications that I read, it's firmly believed that it's on a gradual increase to get better.
Okay.
It's not leaps and bounds, but considering the fact that pollination in this country alone is a $15 billion contribution
right.
to our gross natural product because of all the food that we rely
right.
on that's pollinated by the bees, it could be a huge problem.
Not to mention all the delicious honey that we'd kind of like to have on the grocery stores. So.
Absolutely. You know, it's estimated that one out of every 3 to 4 mouthfuls of food that you eat is somehow connected back to pollination.
Right.
And so it would, if we did have a complete colony collapse, it would be devastating. There would be worldwide famine.
Right. We'd have to invent a new way to do the pollination, which bees do naturally and other insects do naturally.
And that's one of the things that that some researchers have discussed about is managerial practices. Right now in California in the springtime, you can see semi-trucks going up and down the state of California carrying nothing but beehives.
Mm.
People literally rent out their beehives so that agriculturalists, the farmers, can put them in their field
right.
to make sure that they have adequate pollination for their crops.
Absolutely.
And all that transportation takes its toll on the hives as well. It reduces their vigor.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, well, give us a call tonight if you'd like to ask Dr. Beverly Burden about anything having to do with our insect world, bee collapse disorder, or anything else. We are at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 8502. Any question about our insect world, both the fiendish kinds and the friendly kinds of insects are welcome. And it's time, it seems, to start winterproofing our homes. So what advice do you have folks this year?
Well, weather stripping is always a key thing. And one of the rules of thumb that I tell people is that if you can see light through a crack, some creepy crawly insect or not even some creepy crawly arthropods are able to squeeze down and pass through a crack that's just enough to let light come in. And one thing that I would be interested in if people wanted to call in, and that is there seems to be perhaps, I've gotten a few calls on it, but there might be an increase in what we call bagworm populations this year. Bagworms will be on arborvitae, cedars, anything with the small leaves like that. And the caterpillars take and make basically a sleeping bag out of the leaves and with silk. It's very tough. You have to get a pair of scissors to cut open to it. And they can strip a plant pretty fast. And so I've gotten some calls about bagworms. So if there's other people out there that's having problems with that, I'd like to hear more about it.
Has the drought actually increased their population of bagworms, or was this the rain back that we had in May that created what seems to be an increase in this problem?
Twofold. One, the rains in May brought forth a very nice lush spurt of vegetation growth that stimulated the female bagworms, which ironically never leave the bag, to produce more eggs. But then as the drought persisted, the health of the plants declined. And anytime you have a decline in the health of the plants, then the insects can take over faster. Because that's something that we don't discuss a lot on What's Bugging You, but it's been a major emphasis in my research over the years, and that is naturally plant-produced insecticides. Plants produce a lot of chemicals that protect them from insects. And this thymol thing, going back to the bee thing, is a naturally produced plant compound. and it's very common in many of the wildflowers that bees do like to pollinate for nectar. And so technically, bees have been self-medicating themselves with this thymol to protect them from the fungus for thousands of years.
And they may actually have evolved to do just that.
Exactly.
Because the natural environment finds solutions sooner or later. That's all.
Whoever feeds on these plants survive, and those genes persist throughout to the next generation.
That's
absolutely.
All part of that evolutionary process. You are listening to What's Bugging You tonight here on Red River Radio with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight with any question at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about our insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind. And as we get into winter, are there things that folks can do right now to help curtail their flea population? Because we're probably right at that point where they've peaked out all summer long, and now we're trying to know what to do for next year so they're not quite so bad. So what can we do over the winter time to mitigate against flea populations, especially if you have pets and other animals in your neighborhood?
Well, the pets and the other animals are going to have a place where they sleep, whether it's a crate or whether it's their favorite blanket thrown in the corner. And the immatures of fleas are little maggot grub-like organisms that basically feed on dead, decaying organic material, even dead skin, sloughed-off fecal matter from the pet, the cat, or the dog. And so keeping the sleeping area of the dog clean would facilitate that a great bit. And then vacuum, because the adult fleas will hide down into the fibers of the carpet, and then when somebody walks by, they'll jump onto them. We had a couple older cats, and they finally, unfortunately, you know, had to go and meet the maker, the kitty up in the sky. And I didn't know that they had a flea problem until they passed away, and then the fleas started attacking me. And so just be aware of what's going on.
What can they do about backyard fleas, which seems that, at least with my dogs, I tended to have some dogs that enjoyed the outdoors a lot, and of course they filled
There's
up the backyard.
There's some sprays that
fleas.
You can use that's labeled for flea control. Chlorpyrifos is one of the active ingredients, but anything that's marked outdoor flea control should have a good pyrethrin or a good chlorpyrifos insecticide that they can spray. And it's especially the pyrethrins are very ecologically friendly. So you could spray those out in the backyard and feel pretty good about it with other animals and birds.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And she is here to answer your questions tonight about our insect world. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go to our first call tonight. Abby, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Hey, I am having a problem with a pine tree of mine, and I'm not sure if it's not those darn pine beetles or something. You know how insects can attack a pine tree?
Yeah, they are called pine beetles and bark beetles. And the problem with them is that they're so small. They're about half the size of a grain of rice. And what happens is that, especially during these drought conditions, you know, the tree may not be as healthy to fight off the attack. And maybe one or two or three of these beetles will come in. And as they realize that the pine tree is susceptible to attack, they will release a chemical, a pheromone called aggregation pheromone, that actually says, hey, come on over. This is a great pine tree and we're eating it, and come join us. There's plenty for everybody. And then that's when you start to see the health of the pine tree go bad. And about the only thing you can do is to, once it's infested, basically just call it out. If you have other pine trees around there, then you'll want to take the diseased one or the infested one, get it out of there, and to save the other trees, hopefully. And but I would certainly consult a licensed arborist. Call the USDA or the parish office, and one of the best ones we have around here, and I hope he won't get mad that I'll give his name out on radio, but Ricky Kilpatrick is one of the finest arborists that I know of ever. And so call around to the parish offices and see what Ricky can help you out with.
Okay, I can do that. But, you know, what I've been using is Demon Wettable Powder.
I've been putting it,
you know how the pine tree bark has little waves and cracks and mm-hmm. stuff? And I've been, you know, getting it in and under the bark cracks or holes or whatever they are. And it seems to be helping, so I'm not sure. Is this a pine beetle or
peel some other bug? Peel some of the bark off and look for teeny tiny holes. If you see the teeny tiny holes, then that's a pretty good sign that it is the bark beetle. And I'm talking about holes about the size, a little bit bigger than a pencil lead. Or, you know, a grain of rice, something like that. Not big gaping holes. If you see big gaping holes, most of the time, that's the woodpeckers that are after those. But there are some other things that definitely could be affecting the tree. That's why I say, you know, you need to get somebody out there to look at it.
Yeah. Now, where am I going to find this Mr. Kilpatrick? Can you tell me again?
Call the Caddo Parish. Doggone it, it was right on the tip of my tongue.
Would it be Extension?
Extension office, that's
yeah,
it.
Oh, okay.
The Caddo Parish Extension Office, and they'll know how to get a hold of Ricky.
Well, thank you so much.
Sorry, Ricky.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, Abby.
Thank you, Abby.
And just to put a plug in for our Extension offices, they have a wealth of knowledge for anybody out there having any kind of problems. You can give them a call, and they are available for you because that's their job, and we appreciate it. You are listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call tonight about our insect world, anything, at 800-552-8502. And we have Mary and John on hold right now. We're going to go next to Steve, but Mary and John, please stay with us. And Steve, you're online. What's bugging you? Hello, Steve? Okay, maybe I'm with John. John from Minden, what's bugging you tonight?
Okay, I've had a little problem over the summer. Little moths have taken hold in the pantry in some flower that they, I guess, reproduced in. And I've gotten them, I've gotten pheromone glue traps. And they seem to be working, but they keep picking up more. I spread them, actually, one in the bedroom as well. And when I was taking out the little tablets, cardboard tabs with the pheromone, I noticed for the rest of the day moths were, like, flying into me. It's like it was attracting them so much. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to know, is that going to knock them out? Because I got four pheromone traps last week, and you know, occasionally I still see a moth or two.
Yeah, the pheromone traps are very effective in trapping in the moths. The problem is that the pheromones don't work on the immature caterpillars. If it was my pantry, and it has been my pantry before, because I have had them infest my pantry as well, John. They'll get in, and these are called the Mediterranean male moths, by the way. Look those up, Mediterranean male moths. And those are the most common, but there's also an Indian male moth that is less common than it might possibly be. And the little bitty caterpillars, once they get ready to pupate and into the adults, they will crawl away from the flower. I've had them in nuts. I've had them in flour. I've had them in beans. And what I do is I take everything out of the pantry, and just like the flour, you're going to find one or two hot spots. What are they actually breeding in? And then most shelves are removable. I remove the shelves because they like to pupate the immatures in tight places, and just clear everything off, clean everything up, and put everything that you can in a tough plastic container, like a Ziploc or a Tupperware. Don't use Ziploc bags because they can chew through that. In the future, what I do and what's highly recommended is that when you bring flour or any kind of meal home, put it in the freezer for 3 days. And if there's,
really?
Yeah, because if there's any kind of just beginning start of a colony, that will kill them. And one or two, you know, the USDA has limits on how much insecticide parts can be in food. Not that
we don't want to know that, but they do. Yes.
They do, and you know, one or two little bitty caterpillars isn't going to hurt anybody. But yeah, look that up. That will really open a lot of people's eyes up on USDA limitations of insect contamination and food particles. But basically, it's use of pheromone traps, but sanitation, clean. And once you get rid of all the caterpillars and you're starting to get rid of 90% of the adults, nothing's ever going to be 100%, but just keep at it and you'll get it cleaned up.
Yeah, I noticed they got into oatmeal that I had in a container for a while, and I had to dump that.
Just be persistent on any meal. Put it in the freezer before you ever put it in the pantry, and keep on top of it. And like I said, don't rely only on the pheromone traps, because that's never going to clear it up 100%.
All right, thanks. Great advice.
Thank you, John, for calling in.
Yeah.
And we're going to go next to Steve from Bossier City. And yes, Mary and Tim, you're still online, and you are listening to What's Bugging You. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502 with any question about our insect world. Steve, you're online now. What's bugging you?
Hey, good evening.
Good evening.
One question and then a comment. First, back to the fleas. I was told by my vet that if you have fire ants in your yard, that they will control your flea population. Is that true?
Well, I can't deny it. Fire ants are very effective predators, and they would not be preying on the adults, because the adults are going to be on a mammal, but they might be preying on the immatures. And of course, you take out the immatures, then you're going to reduce the adult population as well. And so what would you rather have in your yard, fire ants or fleas? Most people would say, I don't want either one of them. And so if they want to kill the adult fleas, spray the yard with a pyrethrum. And then if you want to control the fire ants, use a chemical called acephate. And that'll take care of both of them.
Well, I have been lucky so far, and I have not found any fleas. I'm a recent moved here from Tennessee, and I don't have any fleas yet. My dog is happy for that. But my comment, spiders. I know they're not insects, but oh, goodness,
that's okay.
I love them. especially jumping spiders. They're so colorful and playful if you can catch them.
I love saltissets.
Oh, they're amazing.
Yeah, they are amazing. They got those two large medium eyes. They almost look, you know, very comical. And if you watch a male and a female, the male will dance for the female, and they are very effective predators, and they have a lot of iridescent greens, and their eyes shine so nice at night. I'm glad that somebody else out there besides me is championing spiders, because they're one of the most beneficial insects you can have in an urban ecosystem in your backyard. Now, I understand a lot of people don't want them in your house. So, again, house, like we were talking about earlier, make sure you have good weather stripping and things like that for your house. And there's only two spiders here that's going to give anybody any problem, and they're not aggressive. People get bit accidentally, and that's the brown recluse and the black widow. Right. Unfortunately, when the brown recluse bites, you really don't feel the bite at that time, and then you see the consequence later. Right. And all of these stories about you got to get your arm cut off, those are extreme cases. Yeah. You know, normally brown recluse problems happen when there's secondary bacterial infection. Black widow, they're not aggressive, but if you disturb them, they will bite. Mm-hmm. And so just be smart.
Black widow webs are pretty easy to identify. Right. They're very, very, their web is very chaotic and very strong.
Yeah, it is.
So, and very sticky as well. So if you touch their web or even get it on a stick, you're not going to get it off unless you stick it under your foot and smash it in the grass. I would just want to encourage people not to kill spiders. They just don't have to, because
Absolutely.
They can control so many insects in your yard that you just don't realize, especially jumping spiders. And if you hold them, I have held every single jumping spider I've ever found, and they've never bitten me, not once. They've never done anything aggressive or defensive. And if you can get them to calm down, you can play with them for a while, then set them in the grass and off they go. Yeah. And they're just, I've seen them in bright reds, bright orange. I've seen them in yellows with golds. And,
very iridescent.
And they're amazing little creatures. And I just want to encourage people not to kill them if they don't have to.
Well, Steve, that's a great comment. And thank you for your call.
All right, thank you. Y'all have a good evening.
You too, Steve. Thank you. And I'm just curious, would those be the wolf spiders that we're talking about?
No,
jumping? Okay.
Salticids are normally relatively small, about the size of your little fingernail.
Right.
And whereas wolf spiders are going to be, you know, bigger than a silver dollar.
Right. Okay.
They're going to be brown and hairy. Salticids, jumping spiders, are also very hairy, but they're not as big as wolves. You could... Two or three salticids, jumping spiders, could ride on the back of a wolf spider easily.
So it's a salticis that I have as a pet in my office, because he every now and then shows his head at my desk and just waves and then moves on down
it
the
could
road.
Be. I'll take a look at it.
All right. Well, you got to find it. He hides most of the time. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 with any question about our insect world, both fiendish and friendly kinds. We have a whole bunch of people online. Please stay with us. We're going to Mary Ann from Gladewater, Texas next. Mary Ann, what's bugging you tonight?
Hi, both of you. Dr. Burden, I love spiders as well and agree with leave them in peace, except when I find a black widow spider and I send those to you.
Exactly. Yeah, I just got the last one about 5 weeks ago.
You have people mailing them.
I watched the postal inspector flip the box over and over and over and over and over to put the postage on it. And I'm thinking, oh, I hope she built a web in there so she's safe. But anyway, I was calling about fleas. I had a friend who had dogs and cats that went in and out of her house. And I asked her, I said, how do you deal with fleas? Because this was down in Houston. And she said, flea busters. And I just kind of recorded it because I was living in apartments. I always lived upstairs, so I wouldn't have that issue and for security. But I found a gorgeous house in the country that I rented and I was going to rent. And when I went to look at it, I had to stop three times before I got out of the neighborhood to brush the fleas off me. It had been vacant for about a month, and the previous tenant had had a dog, so they had just overpopulated. And so I went online and found flea busters, and the powder, it's all non-toxic. The powder you can apply in the house, and it's guaranteed for a year. And what my friend would do is she would shampoo her carpets once a year, and then she would reapply the flea busters. And they also have a product for the yard. It's beneficial nematodes. They send you a little pad, and you put it in a hose-end sprayer and spray the yard. And I think it was about 3 weeks before I moved in, between the time I treated inside and the yard and when I moved in, and there was not a single flea when I moved in.
Yeah, I would be very interested to know what the active ingredient is to this flea buster. I deal mostly with active ingredients than trade names. And
yeah.
With fleas, like I said, there's two ways to attack them. One is to target the immatures. That may be what this flea buster does. It's actually an insect growth regulator, metoprene, that prevents the fleas from ever developing into the adult. And as far as the nematodes, nematodes are fantastic biological control agents because they are very host specific. And if you have a nematode that's going to be host specific for adult fleas, then that would be exactly what you want. And I know they've been working on that for a while, so maybe they finally came through and did that. But there's other things, Loris Ban, Duris Ban, that you can treat the yard with as well. And 2 to 3 weeks is about the right time span. I've also heard, especially if you're going into a vacant house, you can go in and you can spread rock salt all in the, especially if you have wood flooring. And the immatures will, because of the high salt content, they will actually dehydrate. Not a very nice way to leave this world, but they'll die of dehydration. Then you go in, vacuum up all the rock salt, and you're going to be probably, that should take care of your flea problem as well. It's just hard to do if a place is already inhabited.
Yeah, and this is good to spread on wood floors, But the I don't think there's an applicator in Louisiana. I know there's not one in my area, but you would so you would need to go online to order it if anybody's interested. I think it's boric acid, but I might be lying. I don't have the information.
Well, boric acid is a very good natural insecticide, especially for cockroaches as well.
Right, yeah.
I tell people to use boric acid for cockroaches all the time because it's inert. It won't hurt pets and children or anything else. It's a very good ingredient for cockroaches as well.
Okay.
Very good.
Well, thank you all for a really great show.
Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you, Marianne. Okay. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and she is online to answer your questions about what's bugging you tonight. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Tori next from Appleby, Texas, and then we're going to go to Keshada and also Bossier City. Tori, you're online. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, thank you both for taking my call. I really appreciate it, and we both just love your show. I was wondering, when you talk about putting the flour in the freezer, should we also do that with items like our cake mixes and pudding mixes and chips and those types of things?
You could. Chips are so heavily processed, then I wouldn't expect that it would come in with a problem. But that doesn't mean to say if you had a problem, they would definitely want to invade the chips. But things coming in from the retailers would be your grains and flour, oatmeal, and also your nuts, pecans, walnuts, things like that. That's your even your cornmeal.
Okay.
I would do that with those. That would be a very, I do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's, if you have the freezer space to do it, I highly recommend it.
I do. But one more thing about the spiders. We have garden spiders here periodically that have, we love to watch the garden spiders. Do they just not stay around very long? Do they move around? We don't have them long, but we love to see them when they come, the black and yellow ones.
Yeah, they're called the aragope spiders.
Okay.
And I absolutely positively love to watch them as well. They'll, at night, or, you know, at beginning of the night, they'll build these huge, elaborate nets, webs. And for those of you that may not have seen these, you can always tell that it's the garden spider or the aragope spiders because they'll have a very strong white zigzaggy
yes.
band on their webs. And they are extremely beneficial. And then in the morning, they'll tear everything down and put it up the next night. They're very, very efficient in doing that. But it seems like it's during the real middle part of the summer, from mid-June to mid-July. And then when things start drying out at the end of the summer, they do seem to go away. And I'm not sure how they overwinter. They may overwinter as adults or they may overwinter as eggs. I'd have to look that up. But they don't really go away. They just they stop building their beautiful nets.
They'll just hide from us.
They're hiding.
Well, thank you so much, and I really appreciate it. And we, like I say, we love your show and Red River Radio. Thank you.
Thank you, Tori. We appreciate it. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We have lines open right now, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Very curious, is that the banana spider that we knew in Florida, which
yes.
is about the size of your hand?
I mean, it's very huge.
Huge, yes.
Especially when you get from the temperate to the more tropical areas in Florida. They're just the most spectacular spiders.
Yeah.
And Bill, if they don't want to go online, they can leave their question with
sure.
our phone people.
You can leave the questions, and but we do like to talk to you, you know, as
it,
well.
It
but,
is a call-in show.
Yes, but you can definitely leave your question. I was just curious because I was walking doing some photo bugging for some orchids once, and I stepped in a ultra-wet area, and as I almost stumbled forward, there was a banana spider about an inch and a half from my face, and needless to say, my boots are still in that pack of mud.
It probably scared the spider as much as it scared you, Bill.
No, I'm not sure. He didn't move much, but I jumped. So we're going to go next to Tim from Bossier City and LV from Coushatta and Dustin from Kilgore. You're online. Please stay with us. Tim from Bossier City, what's bugging you tonight?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think that I have the new aphid in my crepe myrtles. And I understand that's kind of a new thing to our area, but don't have a clue how to get rid of it. I've tried washing and high pressure hose, and man, I still got them.
Okay, Tim, I think what you're probably talking about, and they're very closely akin to the aphids. Do they look like little fuzzy white dots?
Yes.
Okay.
You have to look even very closely to know that it's not a fungus of some
yeah.
kind, and move it, move something to make them move, that kind of stuff.
I know exactly what they are, and I know exactly what you got to do to take care of them. These are called
Excellent.
The crepe myrtle scale, S-C-A-L-E, and power washing is fine, but if that's not taking care of the problem, then you need to get a compound with the insecticide imidacloprid, I-M-I-D-A-C-L-O-P-R-I-D, imidacloprid. And normally it'll say garden, tree, and shrub insect control. And this is a systemic. You'll depending on the size of the crepe myrtle, depends on how many ounces per gallon of water you put in there. And then you just put the gallon of water with the imidacloprid, with the insecticide around the tree. It soaks down. It's taken up by the roots, because what these scales are doing is they're acting just like a mosquito. They've got their mouth part stuck right into the vascular tissue, and instead of sucking blood like mosquitoes, they're sucking in all the tree sap, and they'll suck
right.
this insecticide right up. And it, we treated all 400 crepe myrtles we have on the LSUS campus two summers ago, and it does the trick, absolutely.
And will it still work this time of year?
It should, as long as the trees are still have viable leaves on them, and they're taking in moisture, it'll work. But
Thank
I get it on there
much.
Sooner than later.
Indeed. Thank
okay.
you very much.
You're welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Tim, for calling in. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call about anything having to do with our insect world, both fiendish and friendly, right now at 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. We have three lines open, so plenty of room for new callers. We have Dustin from Kilgore. You're online. We'll get to you next. But right now we're going to LV from Coushatta. LV, what's bugging you tonight?
Yes, I have a real problem with fleas, and I appreciate you taking my call. I don't know what the answer is. I've got a lot of pine trees, and one of the questions is, are they worse in the pine straw than they are anywhere else, and what could I do to get rid of them?
Well, are they outside instead of inside, LV?
Outside, yes.
Okay.
I've got a little poodle, and I cannot hardly let him out in the yard, that he don't come back in with some fleas on him.
There's, to answer your question, the fleas probably are not in the pine straw. The reason being is that pine straw is very, very dry, and fleas prefer to have moisture environments. So it would probably be more in the green vegetation than in the dead, dry pine straw. And so I would go get a chemical called Lorsban or Dursban. It has the active ingredient in it is chlorpyrifos. That's chlorpyrifos. Chlorpyrifos. Follow the directions and apply that to your vegetation outside. Give it a few days, and you should see a significant reduction in your flea population.
Oh, very good. I will sure give that a try, because they have been a problem the whole summer.
Yes, ma'am. Good luck with that.
All right. Thank you so much.
What about the applications that some people will put on their dogs? Are those effective for fleas and ticks?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's why I wanted to clarify that she wanted to treat the outside rather
right.
than the dog itself. What happens is that you'll apply this chemical to the dog. When the fleas feed on the blood of the dog, and fleas are pulled blood feeders. They don't feed like mosquitoes. They don't actually insert mouth parts into the tissue. They will create a little wound, and the blood will pool up in there, and they basically lap that up. But it contains an insect growth regulator, normally mithaprine, and the mithaprine will prevent the adult from laying another component of eggs. So it kind of acts as a birth control agent for the adults.
Essentially, it won't get rid of the adults, but it'll get rid of the next generation. And their lifespans are fairly short anyway.
That's right.
So after a while, then the adults will die off, but no new generation will come along.
But the thing about it, fleas can go up weeks to weeks without feeding and still be alive.
Right.
So.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have three lines open, and we're going next to Dustin from Kilgore. Dustin, what's bugging you tonight?
Yes, thank you for y'all's time. Basically, I have two mystery bugs. We have a small child, and that's led me to pay more attention to what's around in our environment. And the first one, it almost mimics an ant. It's very large, and it's red on black, alternating, red on either end and black in the middle. And they're very fast and fuzzy, and they like to frequent concrete areas, I've noticed.
Yeah, Dustin, these are called velvet ants, and they're not an ant. They are actually a wingless female wasp. The males are winged, and they will look very similar, and they'll have this red and black velvet structure. It's actually very small, tiny hairs that we call setae. And I would leave them alone. They are predators, but they're not aggressive. And one of the reasons they seem to be on concrete is because you can see them really good on concrete. But if you notice it in the grass and stuff, they'll be down there hunting and foraging. If you have them in your yard, don't let your kids out there because they have a very, very powerful stinger. A lot of the locals around here call them cow killers or cow ants for that reason. What's your second mystery ant, Dustin? I mean, mystery insect.
The second one is I have two large live oaks around my home, and I live on some very sandy soil. And I've noticed some depressions in the sandy soil that almost mimic a funnel or maybe an inverted pyramid. And occasionally, as I sit there and watch it, I'll see little puffs of dirt that seem to be emitted from the hole that goes into the ground.
Know exactly what you have. And by the way, that is a fantastic description. What's creating these little inverted funnels are the immatures of what we call ant lions. The adults look very, very much like damselflies, except they have a very large knobbed antenna. But the immatures will create these pits, and ants will come along, and they'll fall down in these pits. And these ant lion immatures will take, and they have two large mandibles, and they'll stick it into the ant, suck out all the ant blood, and then toss them back up out of the hole. Now, if you want to actually see one of these guys, take your hands and scoop up the funnel and then just start blowing the fine particles of dirt away, and you'll see this little bitty thing, and they run backwards. We used to call them doodle bugs.
Uh-huh.
And but they're just part of the natural ecosystem, and the sandy soil is their favorite. So you have a perfect environment for these doodle bugs. They're completely harmless, and as are the adults.
Okay, and can I indulge you on one more question?
Certainly.
If you notice, and we don't very, very often have problems with insects in the home, but I have on a rare occasion noticed what appears to be an ant, but root moves rather slowly and lethargic. It doesn't look similar to a fire ant or any other ant or a crazy ant, as I've called them, as I've seen on my property. But they're black, they're small compared to a fire ant, but they move very, very slow, very, very lethargic.
Yes, what you're describing is actually the common name is the tiny black ant. And like you said, that's the perfect description for them. Just like any ant, they are workers, and they're out there foraging and looking for something to eat that they'll then go back to their colony and establish a trail to the food source. And most of the time, if you're not seeing a whole lot, there just may just be a few that's lost in your house, and I would just sweep them up if you're concerned about your child, but they are no medical concern at all. It's just a nuisance ant.
Okay, great. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dustin. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 with any question about our insect world. We're going to go to Belinda next from Leesville. Belinda, you're online. What's bugging you?
Hey, I just wanted to say how much I love Red River Radio. I'm a listener member, and I love Dr. Burden's show. I hate when I have to miss it. I have used, on the subject of fleas and dogs, I've used the beneficial nematodes. It's been one of the best things I've ever tried. Terrible thing is when we have extreme weather, like hot summers and super cold winters, those first 2 weeks of January, then you have to reapply.
Yep. They're not going to be able to overwinter in extreme cold. And luckily, the fleas are not active during those times as much on the outside. They'll still remain active on the inside. And one thing that I didn't get to say earlier when LV was on the line is that I was talking about the growth regulators, the birth control, so you don't have any more young. But these nice flea shampoos, they have a pyrethrin in them. They do a great job. You know, shampoo your pet if you can't control anything outside, and that'll really help to knock down the flea problem with adults on the pet.
What about essential oils? Is there anything I can do with them?
The essential oils are not going to be a killing agent. The essential oils might deter the fleas from that environment. Depends on how much oil you put on them. It's almost like there used to be a wives' tales that if your school had a lice problem, then just take baby oil and baby oil up your hair and your kid won't get lice. But I would go ahead and go with the pyrethrins, especially because fleas can transmit dog tapeworms. And so I wouldn't want the adults on my dog.
Definitely not. And I've also used diatomaceous earth food grade as a sort of flea powder.
That's interesting. That wouldn't do anything for the adults. It might do something for the immatures, because what dichotomous earth does is it acts as an abrasion, like little glass particles to eat away and to break away the exoskeleton. It is more commonly effective against soft-bodied insects. Flea adults are not soft-bodied. Those things, if you're going to smash one, it's very hard to smash a flea. You have to put a lot of PSI, pounds per square inch, on that guy. And so it might be more effective against the immatures, but I don't think it would be very effective against the adults.
I have one last thing. I've also given the DE internally in the food to control internal parasites.
That might work for internal parasites, but I would first want to establish whether my animal had internal parasites before I would go and feed them dichotomous earth. And any vet can take a fecal matter, a fecal smear, and give you an answer back on that pretty quick.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Belinda. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. We have a whole bunch of people online. Billy, Pierre, and Pete, please hang on. Carla, next up. Carla is passing through the area, but Carla, what's bugging you?
Well, normally I listen to KERA, but I'm really enjoying this show, and we'll try and tune in to Red River Radio when I get online.
All right.
I was wondering, I have a camper, and campers are really hard to keep sealed. And as I'm thinking about winterizing, two of the things that I've seen a lot online as being problems in campers are, one is ants and the other one is wasps. So for ants, I mean, of course, I'm not going to leave any food in there, or, you know, even if it's packaged, I'm not going to leave any food over the winter in my camper. But it's really hard to get rid of, like, every little food particle. So I was wondering if you had any suggestions for ants in a camper. And then the wasps, I had read that you could actually use a flea collar around where your gas tank is, and that will help you avoid wasp invasion, but I don't know if that's true or not, and does that even make sense?
Okay, for with ants, you're not only going to be concerned with food particles, but also with moisture sources. So make sure that all of your water hoses are not leaking water. So take care of water and take care of food. That's going to take care of the ant problems. With the wasp problem, I wouldn't take any measures to control the wasp unless I knew that there were wasps there. Wasps are very, very attracted to yellow. Go to the dollar store somewhere and get you some shallow yellow bowls. Put water in there and add some dishwashing soap to it. The wasps will be attracted to that yellow bowl. When they hit the soapy water, that will kill them. And that's a very cheap, effective way of monitoring your wasp problems. And then if you find out if you have a wasp problem, then you need to find the nest. And then you can take care of the nest probably just mechanically by knocking it off the wall and dislodging it and killing the nest.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, Carla. And you are listening to What's Bugging You. And we're going to go to Billy next. Billy from Manny, Louisiana. You're online right now. What's bugging you? Hello, Billy. Well, maybe I got the wrong one. Maybe this is Pete from Zavala. Pete, what's bugging you tonight?
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, I'm here. I've been seeing out in the woods. Thanks for being there, guys. I wasn't expecting. I was waiting for Billy and Pierre. I've been stick insects, but it's not an insect. It's got eight legs. But it looks like a little stick bug. What am I seeing around here?
There are some spiders that are extremely elongated in nature. Stick bugs are going to be dark brown. These elongated spiders are more tan or yellowish. What color are these mystery
kind of
organisms?
They're a lighter brown, yes. I just thought it was, but they have eight legs. And
yeah, if they have eight legs, it's not going to be an insect. It's going to be a spider. However, this time of the year, it is not uncommon to see mating pairs of walking sticks. The males actually cling to the back of the females while they're mating, and it may be that you're seeing an extra pair of legs because of the male that's there and not seeing the other two pairs. And that would be probably what you're seeing. Mating pairs where it appears to have eight legs, but in fact, there's probably 12 there.
All right. Well, great. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right.
Thank you, Pete. And now we're going to go to, I believe, if we get it correct, Pete from Manny. Pete, you're online. What's bugging you? Hello. Billy from Manny. I'm sorry. Billy from Manny. What's bugging you tonight?
We're having a problem with Bill.
Well, we can hear Billy, but he can't hear us, so we're going to have to move on, and we're going to go to Pierre from Bossier City. Pierre, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, nothing is bugging me anymore, but I have a tip. I used to be having problem with fleas, and I would spray the yard, I spray the house, and you get into control more or less for a while, and you come back. I bought something at a feed store the other day that sprays. You give the pill to the dog. One pill about every 10 days. I haven't seen a flea on a dog or in a house since.
Yeah, that would be one of those insect growth regulators that I was talking about earlier. And it's basically acting as a birth control pill, not for the dog, but it circulates through the dog's bloodstream. Mm-hmm.
It's
excellent.
It's called MITENPYRAM.
Well, if it ends in THRIN, then you shouldn't be feeding it to your dog because that's a pyrethrin. But good to know. Good to know. Thank you for your call, Pierre.
Thank you.
And you are listening to What's Bugging You. We're going to get to our next question right now. And this is Andrew from Appleby, Texas. Andrew, what's bugging you tonight?
Listening to What's Bugging You. We're going to get to our next question right now.
Hello, Andrew.
Turn down your radio.
Hello, Andrew.
Turn
down your radio.
All right. He obviously is not paying attention right now. So, and we are out of calls right now, but we have lines open, 800-552-8502. If you get your call in quick, we can still have time to get it in. And while we're waiting on that, I wanted to ask what we can do to make our backyards honeybee friendly for the fall.
Yeah, for honeybee friendly for the fall, you'll want to make sure that that there might be a source of water. But at the same time, the mosquitoes are still going to be around these days, too. So make sure that you empty the water out 2 or 3 days to not allow the immatures, the mosquitoes, to develop. There are some plants that that you may be able to plant here that may be nectar-friendly, things like the red clover, the foxglove. I'm not sure how well those overwinter. But a lot of times during the winter, the activity of the bees decrease anyway. And so also don't use any unnecessary pesticides around the house. A lot of people are very concerned that a type of pesticides called neonicotinoids have been contributing to the colony collapse disorder. But that's only been, it's just been, there's no scientific basis for it. You know, a lot of times people confuse correlation with cause and effect, and that's just not the case here. But those would be the things I would do. Water source, not use insecticides indiscriminately.
All right, we have a couple of minutes to go to another caller here. I don't have a name, but we're just going to go ahead and take it. What's bugging you tonight? You're on the air. Hello?
I think that's Andrew back.
Yeah, well, we're going to go to the next one. What's bugging you tonight?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I'm talking to you.
Okay, I couldn't tell if you were talking to me or not. I had a question. You were talking about fleas earlier. You were talking about Dursban. Is that something that's bad for your animals in the yard? So if you treat your yard for fleas and stuff, do you need to keep them out in the yard for a while after that?
Well, it's been a while since I've read the label to Dursban, but oftentimes, there are re-entry periods. I would not let the animal out there for maybe a couple of days, have them go in the front yard instead of the backyard. And I would only go to Dursban if I really had a severe problem. That's, okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, good. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to go now to Billy from Manny. Billy, what's bugging you tonight?
Yes, early in the spring, got warm. I filled all my gas jugs up, getting ready to mow grass, and some kind of insect drilled holes in all of my red gas jugs. And some of them had a little black larva sticking out of. It was like a 1/8 diameter hole, and there was just hundreds of them in there and drained all the gas. But I was just wondering what that was.
I don't know if... There are a few beetles that drill holes in hardwoods, but why they would drill holes in a gas tank befuddles me. And so if you were able to catch some and send them to me, I could give you a more detailed analysis. But I've never heard of that happening before, and so it may be something other than insects. If it's not a beetle, it's an ant, but even that, you've got me on that one.
Yeah, they was even drilling holes in the bottoms, and it was draining the gas out, so it had to get on them, had to kill them, I would think.
Yeah, I have no idea.
I have pictures of the jugs. I never caught any. Didn't think about it. There was larva. I guess I should have saved some of those, but maybe next spring?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you give me email address or something?
Absolutely. My email address is, and I get a lot of emails, so this is fine. I don't mind giving this out. My name is Beverly Burden, B-E-V-E-R-L-Y. My email address is beverly.burden@lsus.edu. Send me photographs. I love photographs.
And Burden is spelled B-U-R-D-E-N.
That's correct.
Yes, B-U-R-D-E-N.
B-U-R-D-E-N @lsus.com.
Edu.
Yes.
Not com. Edu.
.edu, not com.
Okay, edu. Okay, yep. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And that is, unfortunately, all the time we have. We still have some calls online, and we apologize for not being able to get to you. You have been listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and Red River Radio's resident entomologist. And Beverly, we want to thank you once again for joining us.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
We'd like to thank each of you for calling in tonight and hope that you'll join us for another edition of What's Bugging You, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Tune in on Tuesday, November 17th at 6 p.m. for the next edition of Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and stay tuned. Coming up next here on Red River Radio is Radiolab. What's Bugging You is produced by Bill Beckett and Beverly Burden with assistance from Wally Derleth and Tim Snell. Dr. Beverly Burden is our resident entomologist, and I'm your host, Bill Beckett. This has been a production of Red River Radio, and we are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches.